Thank you to the organizers for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. Can you hear me? So the goal of this paper is to study efficiency stability trade-off for different financial architectures. And the idea is to try to derive some implications for the desired structure of financial system, to think about the costs and benefits of large interconnected financial institutions, to understand better the relationship between diversification and contagion. And to do that, I'm going to use slightly different comparative statics to what is used in the literature. So instead of changing density of the network and trying to see how stability and efficiency changes, what I will do is I will fix the density, so the number of links is going to be the same. What I will do is I will reallocate the links across banks. So I will go from the more heterogeneous network to less to more homogeneous network, and this comparative statics is going to highlight the benefits and cost of having a financial architecture with small number of very interconnected banks. And for the contagion analysis, what I will do is I will use the model of trading in over-the-counter market to calculate endogenous exposures between banks. And then the cascades of failure in the financial system will depend on these endogenous exposures. So this is a slide that's supposed to give you a sort of overview of this framework. And I do think that this part is like a framework, how you can use a model to study efficiency and stability. So what we are trying to do is I want to study these two objects as a function of the financial architecture, which I define as a set of trading relationships that is not observable to econometricians or to policymakers. And I want to change, I don't know if there is a clicker here. So I want to change this thing, and I want to see how that changes efficiency and stability. Now, the problem is the following, that there are networks of different sizes, and they have many dimensions that you can potentially change. So the first step of the analysis is going to try to find some reasonable configuration for the network to start with. And for that, I'm going to use simulated method of moments to calibrate the model to the observable data coming from the federal funds market. So the idea is the following. Let's try to find parameters about the network structure, which is going to be parameterized as a parameter of preferential attachment model, a price setting mechanism such as bargaining or auctions, and some distribution and of shocks and some frequency, like the arrival rate of shocks. So let's try to find parameters that are here such that once you trade in the model, once you go here, the network of trades that you observe has similar characteristics to the real network of trades. And I will focus on five network statistics to do this exercise, but in theory you can add as many as you want. So I will focus on density, how interconnected are the banks, what is the amount of intermediation in the market, and what is the size of this network of trades. So I just want you to keep in mind these two objects. One is the equilibrium network of trades in a given day, let's say, and another one is the potential network of trades that we don't observe. Once we did this calibration analysis, we can forget about this part. And what we can do, we can jump straight to this part. So we can say, OK, for these parameters that we observe, what is efficiency, what is stability, what happens if you change it? So let me give you some illustration of the model using an example. So the way that I think about over-the-counter market, I think about it as a resource allocation mechanism. There are some endowment shocks, and the model maps these endowment shocks to equilibrium outcomes. So let's say that we have five banks, and they have trading relationships, which are not observable. Two banks will trade, provide a loan to each other, only if they have a trading relationship. They will trade directly. Think about it, maybe they trust each other, or they know to manage counterparty risk. Then we have some shocks. So in general, there are many shocks, but let's try to see about a case where you have just one endowment shock. Bank number one gets excess liquidity. All other banks have some demand for liquidity, which is modeled as the private value for liquidity, normalized to be between 0 and 1. In this realization of these private valuations, it turns out that bank number four has the highest need for liquidity, so, and that would be the first best allocation. So that's feasible first best allocation. The question is, when banks trade, you know, try to maximize their profits optimally, will they eventually, through the chain of intermediation, reach this first best allocation? If not, then we have inefficiency, and then we can quantify it and see how it depends on the network structure. So the trading depends on the network structure, because the network structure affects the amount of intermediation in the market, but also price setting mechanism is going to be important. So for the calibrated price setting mechanism, what you get is that the equilibrium allocation is not going to be efficient. The bank number one will provide a loan to bank number five, and it will create a welfare loss of 0.4. I'm going to focus on surplus loss. So I will say, okay, from the maximum surplus that was possibly possible to create given this realization of endowment and valuation shocks, what percent of it was lost? And that's 57% in this case. Now, what is the intuition for this welfare loss? So the intuition is that prices between banks depend not only on the private valuations, but also on the shares of surplus that intermediaries receive. So if intermediaries are not strong enough, they don't receive high enough surplus, it means that their resale value is not high enough to compensate the original seller. In this case, bank number two cannot have price, which is resale price to bank number three, high enough to give enough good enough price to bank number one, and bank number one doesn't care about efficiency, just cares to get the highest price, and he gets the highest price when he sells to bank number five. So there is a leakage of surplus along this chain, and for this realization of shocks, it was inefficient. Now, the idea is not to think about financial architecture as just one realization of shocks. I want to think about it as millions of shocks that hit the system. Sometimes bank number one gets the endowment, sometimes bank number two. The banks have different reserve requirements that change over time. So the idea is to think how efficient is any particular financial architecture on average. So for that, we want to be able to solve first for large networks with thousands of banks, and second, we want to average the surplus loss across millions of shocks. So that will not be feasible if you just try to solve this type of model by like backward induction, because it's not always possible to do it when you have circles and loops and so on. So for that, the way that I do it is I define the system of equations. I'm trying to find a fixed point for the endogenous valuation for this asset. And it turns out that this fixed point, this system of equations, which basically defines that endogenous valuation of each bank is the maximum between its private valuation and the resale value, where the resale value depends on the optimal trading decision of the buyer. So this system of equation is contraction mapping. And that means that if you iterate it, you will converge very fast to a unique equilibrium, and you can solve it thousands of times in a very short period, meaning that you can compute average efficiency for large networks. And prices here are forward-looking. Everyone takes into account the optimal trading decisions of everyone else. You know, so in that sense, there is some dynamics going on in terms of allocation of this asset in this network. So now let's talk a little bit about how good is the model to feed the data. So here's just one slide to give you some sense in terms of visualizing these networks. So the one on the right is taken from the paper by Beck and Atalay. What they show is how the Fed funds market looks like on September 29, 2006. So you see, you know, the standard properties of many interbank markets. You have a low density, you have some very interconnected banks. In this case, they put bank with the highest, the bank that borrows the most is positioned in the center, and then its counterparties in the first circle, counterparties of counterparties in the second circle, and so on. And there is a substantial amount of intermediation in the market. What you see on the left is just random day of trading for the model. So it just, I picked randomly one day, and that's what the model generates. So it also has similar density, it has a similar amount of intermediation, it has a large number of, like a small number of very interconnected banks. If you want, so let me just emphasize one thing here. This network that you see on the slide is not the financial architecture. The financial architecture that I uncover through this SMM procedure is twice larger and three times more dense. So that's just one day of shocks, because we don't see all banks trade every day, and we don't observe all possible trading relationships when they trade. Now, in terms of the moments that I try to target and so on, so I have average density, maximum number of lenders to a single bank, maximum number of borrowers from a single bank, average number of active banks per day, maximum number of intermediaries. And that's all averaged over 250 trading days for year 2006. And as you can see, the model can match the data relatively well. I use three parameters, as I said, to match the five moments, and only one of these parameters is actually relevant for efficiency and stability analysis. There are also five moments that I report which are standard deviations over time, so over these 250 days, for each one of these five moments, so here. And they also match relatively well, even though they were not targeted in this optimization procedure that when I tried to match the moments. So now we have, so if you remember the first slide that I gave you, so now I can forget this realized network of trades. I go back to this unobservable parameter. So I have bargaining power that depends, a seller is going to get higher share of surplus whenever he has more counterparties. So that's a result. I considered also second price auction and so on. But that's what fits the data. The data is the best. The distribution of shocks is going to be uniform, uniform distribution of endowment shocks, and uniform distribution of shocks for private valuations. So we have that. Now we can jump into this more interesting part, in my opinion, which is to try to understand the comparative statistics between the network structure, efficiency, and stability.
Sorry, it was not totally clear to me what model of bargaining you're using.
Right. Oh, sorry. I mean, it's so basically there are several models that I consider. And the one that turns out to work is the one where the seller receives share of surplus, which is 1 minus 0.5 divided by number of counterparties. What it means is when you have only one potential buyer, you split the surplus equally. When you have infinite number of buyers, you get all the surplus. And that's just a parameterization that turns out to work. I considered second price auction. It was not as good in fitting the data. Okay?
But this is there's no strategic model behind it.
Right. That it's just you try to find. Yeah, so there is potentially something in the background.
It's a rule that
right, exactly. That's exactly right. And that's just, I view it a little bit different. It gives us guidance for what type of strategic models we want to consider. So I consider the one where the bargaining power depends on the number of counterparties to the buyer. And that doesn't fit the data as well. So in some sense, and if you share the surplus equally, it also doesn't fit the data. So there is something about what type of models we want to build. But that's not more than that. OK, so now what is this plot about? So on the y-axis is the expected surplus loss. So they're just averaging the surplus loss that I showed you in the example over millions of shocks. And what I have here on the x-axis is this comparative statistics that I was talking about. So the point on the right, which is 171, this is the calibrated architecture. So it turns out that once you calibrate the financial architecture, a bank has on average 100, there exists a bank that on average has 171 counterparties. Now, the other nine architectures are just counterfactual architectures where they are more homogeneous in terms of distribution of links across the banks. And what you see here is what is the maximum number of counterparties. So in this architecture, no bank has more than 120 counterparties. If you take this constraint to the extreme, you get to this point, which is almost regular network where all banks have exactly the same number of counterparties, which is 22. So and then the question is how this welfare is changing as a function of this if you want to think about it, it's like a standard deviation of the degree distribution, holding the mean constant. And what we find is that the current structure is more efficient than any counterfactual architecture, and the intuition is the following. When you have a very interconnected bank, it allows to have a very short intermediation chains when you allocate from the endowment shocks to the final allocations. When you put these constraints and you make the system more homogeneous, the length of the intermediation chains increases, and as a result, this intermediation friction becomes more pronounced, and then you have high expected surplus loss. Here it's measured in percent relative to the constraint efficiency given this network. So that's the blue line. this one is expected surplus loss. So that's in percent. When you have, for a given allocation, you will have some surplus loss. It can be zero, it can be positive, and you average across millions of shocks, endowment shocks, valuation shocks, draws of the network. So that's like average measure of efficiency for this class of networks that have this maximum number of counterparties. That's the blue line.
So how do you explain the non-monotone?
So let me get there. But what I am talking now is the blue line. The blue line is what is the efficiency in normal times, no contagion. That just says this: if you calculate what is the average distance in each of these architectures, the correlation between the blue line and the average distance is 97%. So all of this line is explained by the average distance in the network, so average amount of intermediation. The red line is what you was asking about, is what happens in case of contagion. So let me describe what contagion I have in mind, because different people, different papers have different, I think, exercises, different scenarios. So what I have in mind is the following. I fail the most interconnected bank in each network. And then I calculate what is the exposure of all banks to every other bank, where exposure is based on the volume of trade between them. Exposure of bank A to bank B is going to be the loans that bank A provided to bank B divided by total loans provided by bank A. So that's what is the percent of loans provided to bank B out of all the loans that bank A has. And then the rule is the following. Assume that there is some liquidity requirement, says that banks should have 15% liquidity against their loan portfolio. If the bank, so the original kind of scenario, what triggers the contagion is that the most interconnected bank fails. Then let's look for all its counterparties, whether any of them have exposure more than 15% to this bank. If they do, they will fail as well. And then you have additional wave of contagion where any bank that has exposure above 15% to the any bank that failed before is going to fail as well. And then you have this cascade. After a while, the cascade will stop. And you will have a new financial architecture where only there are only remaining banks and remaining links. And then what I do, I let the model trade for this remaining network, and I calculate expected surplus loss again. And then what you see is, if the expected surplus loss increases a lot, then it means that the system is not very stable. So what you find is that the current structure is relatively stable. The most homogeneous structure, which is here on the left, is relatively unstable because the expected surplus loss is going above 7%. And then you see that there is non-monotonicity. I will explain non-monotonicity in two slides. Let me just show you another measure of stability, which is the most standard measure that people in this room are using, which is what is the total number of banks that will fail? So the total number of banks that will fail when you average across many simulations, what you find is the similar pattern. First, that the current structure is more stable than the most homogeneous one. Out of 1,000 banks, there are 30% or 40% fail here and 50% fail there. And then there is non-monotonicity going on in the middle. What is the intuition for that?
Michael?
Yeah?
The error bars are the standard errors that you
have. Yes.
Very small.
Yes, very small. It's right. Okay, so now let me give you intuition for what's going on. So, and to give intuition, I think it's enough to have 6 banks, should be enough.
Can I just ask you, because you talk about loans, but so far until you first pronounced this word, you haven't talked about any loans going on between the
Right, so when I...
Although the blue, it came the loans.
It's good that you stopped me. So it's just a matter of terminology. When I talk about asset, I just think about liquidity as an asset. So if I have endowment shocks, so what does it mean, endowment shock? Someone comes and puts a deposit. Now this bank has excess liquidity. It can either use it, to provide a loan by itself to some entrepreneur, or can use interbank market to allocate this liquidity to someone that needs it more, maybe to satisfy reserve requirements. So every time I'm talking about asset is sold, it means that the bank provides a loan. Okay? Thanks for stopping. Okay, so now we have this 5 banks. 6 banks, 1 bank in the center, and then 5 banks in the periphery. If you notice, you think about links as you know, a resource, and think about the allocation of diversification in the system. The allocation of diversification benefits is very asymmetric. All the benefits of diversification are allocated to the bank in the middle, in the center, and the banks in the periphery, they have, you know, no diversification, they are very concentrated, they have 100% exposure to the bank in the center. So you can calculate these exposures numerically, analytically. You, given that all the shocks are uniform, you get 20% exposure to each of the periphery banks, and each of the periphery banks has 100% exposure to the bank in the center. The idea is that if the bank in the center fails, all banks will fail. So we have, in this star structure, which is one extreme, 5 banks fail if the most interconnected bank fails. Let me redistribute these benefits of diversification a little bit more equally between banks. So now I have 2 core banks and 4 periphery banks. You can recalculate exposures by using the model, and you see that inter-core exposure is dropping to 45%, and then again, the banks in the periphery, they have 100% exposure to the banks in the center. If one of these 2 banks fails, and the liquidity requirement is 50%, it will trigger failure of 2 banks. Let's take it one more step and create the most homogeneous diversification allocation as possible. So we have 2 core banks, 2 middle tier banks, and 2 periphery banks. You recalculate exposures again, and you see that the exposure between 2 core banks goes to 53%, meaning if one of these 2 banks fails and there is 50% requirement, again, 5 banks fail. So we go from 5 banks fail, 2 banks fail, and 5 banks fail.
The most diversified or ring?
The most diversified. Oh, that's true. But you remember, I have this additional constraint that the number of links across these 3 architectures should be the same. To create a ring, I will need to add one more link. But I think that the intuition should be kind of similar. So the intuition is that the non-monotonicity happens because in the first structure, you put all the diversification benefits in the center. This bank fails, and everyone else have high exposure. In the homogeneous case, you try to allocate a diversification equally across banks, but then they have exposure potentially above the threshold so that you create this long cascade of failures. And then there is this interior solution where you have diversification allocated not completely equally, but also not to the extreme that only one bank has all the benefits, and that looks to be more stable. So that's my take on this non-monotonicity. Maybe there is another explanation or additional explanation, but that's so far what I could figure out using this example. Now, let me talk about a little bit different specification, which is a work in progress. But it looks like that it makes a big difference in terms of the stability outcome. So far, what we saw, that there is no trade-off between efficiency and stability. The structure that has core periphery structure with small number of very interconnected banks is more efficient, and that's, you know, I think that it's more clear. And it's also more stable because of the analysis that we had so far. So there is no trade-off, and we should not have, you know, try to make the system more homogeneous. But there was one assumption that I used here when I calculated this contagion. I said a bank fails if it has exposure above 15% to any failed bank. And then what happens is that the bank in these large interconnected banks, they're relatively diversified. They don't have exposure above 15% to so many banks. That's why they are relatively stable. Consider alternative. Consider the following. A bank fails if exposure to all banks that failed in the previous round is above the threshold. So it's cumulative measure. In this case, if you use this cumulative measure, what you find is that the current structure is relatively, it's more fragile relative to other structures. And the intuition is the following, the way that I understand it, but again, I'm happy to if we can discuss it later, is in the beginning, the banks in the core, they are not exposed to each other too much, and they are not exposed to any of the periphery banks. The periphery banks that have high exposure to these core banks. Now, one core bank fails, and it fails a bunch of small banks, but no one really cares in terms of welfare because they are not having any important intermediation function, so it doesn't show up in the expected surplus loss. And the shock is not coming back to the core because the core system is isolated from every one of them separately. what this cumulative losses scenario does, it says, well, what can happen is the following. A big bank fails, hundreds, 200 small banks in the periphery fail. There is another core bank that has exposure to the same 200 banks. This exposure is below the threshold for each individual bank, but when you look on all of them together, it's above the 15%. So the shock goes from the core to the periphery, comes back to the core, and then goes back and forth until almost 97% of all the banks fail. And the question is, which of these two scenarios is more realistic? I think it depends on the frequency of the shock. So the original scenario was assuming the following. If there are, in the first wave, there is no difference. Big bank fails, only counterparties above with exposure above 15%, they will fail. So that's the same. But then you need to think, okay, what about if two counterparties fail in the same time, how that affects the some other bank? And if the default happens simultaneously, exactly in the same time, then we should use the cumulative losses. But if there is some timing between the failure of the first bank and the second bank that allows to the third bank, that the one that we are considering now, to recapitalize, maybe to sell some assets and to gain liquidity to absorb the second shock, then you should use the previous scenario. So in some sense, there is importance here about how the liquid is the market, how fast you can gain liquidity, or how fast you can raise capital, and that will determine substantially how stable is the financial system. So that's, again, that's preliminary results, but I think it worth some discussion. Let me give some final remarks, what I learned by working on this project. So the first takeaway for me was that efficiency is as important as stability, but I think that many times it's just omitted from the policy discussions. It's rarely quantified, because given the recent memory of the crisis, everyone is focused on stability. But in some sense, this crisis type of events happen once in a while, maybe 1% probability of this type of a crisis. But trading happens all the time. So if we think about markets as resource allocation mechanism, we should be concerned about how efficient it in 99% of the time, and to think about if we do some policy intervention, how it's going to affect not just stability, but also efficiency. The second point is that it's important for, especially for financial regulation, it's important to bridge the gap between theory and empirics. There is no way to compute welfare without a model, because you observe quantity and prices, you don't see welfare. But on the other side, if the model can match some data, it makes this calculation a little bit more reliable and maybe relevant. The third point is that it's important how you compute the exposures. If the exposure is just assumed, or is it just you assume that the propagation happens by some random process like epidemics, you get a very different results for stability than if you use a model to compute exposures, because the direction of the exposure and the extent, the quantity of the exposure is going to be important for these cascades. Finally, if we want to understand the cost and benefits of two interconnected or failed banks, I think that the relevant comparative statistics is not to change the density, but to change the standard deviation of the degree distribution, holding density constant. And my concern is the following. When you change density, you don't know whether efficiency or stability change because you have more links now, or because there is change in the heterogeneity of diversification across banks. So I think that this is a type of comparative statistics that just allows us to pinpoint exactly what's going on by isolating other effects that many people in this room studied. Last minute, I just wanted to talk about some model limitations and what can be interesting to do in the future. So obviously, trying to figure out this cumulative contagion, how it works, and to what extent it's realistic, I think is important. So I will keep working on that. That should be relatively easy to do. Incorporating counterparty risk in the trading stage is difficult. So far, what I did, I assumed that if you have a link, it means that you trust this counterparty, so you assume that the counterparty risk is relatively small. Once in a while, there is some big crisis, some large bank fails, and then you have this contagion. But it's not like priced. I didn't price it ex ante. Pricing it ex ante will require to solve this fixed point, because the price is affect exposures, exposures affect counterparty risk, and then it feeds back. So that sounds like a complicated problem. In terms of the dynamics, so there are many questions here about is it dynamic or not. So let me just try to be as explicit as possible, and we can discuss. For a given realization of shocks, if you think about this room, that's the market. I put a shock in one place. There is a dynamics in this space. Who is trading, where this liquidity is going will be, you know, determined by forward-looking prices and so on. But what I do is I solve this problem many, many times. There are IID shocks. And the model fit, as you saw, is very good. But maybe it could be even better if you think about some non-IID shocks where traders anticipate some shortage in liquidity and it changes their trading behavior. Again, I'm not aware about models that have both dynamics in space and in time for non-atomic agents, but I think that's definitely something to do, and that will be interesting. And finally, the strategic network formation. So there is a network formation here. That's what I need to calibrate this model, but it's preferential attachment. So there is no too much strategic interaction in this case. And that's fine when you do comparative statics like the way that I did. But if you really want to think about regulation, it's really good to have a network formation model because it will narrow down the set of potential networks that will emerge once regulators put constraints on the current structure. And that's and then it's much more policy relevant to calculate efficiency and stability consequences for these endogenously formed networks under the constraints than just to do comparative statics that I did. So that's it. Thanks so much, and happy to hear your comments. Thanks. Do we have some time for questions?
For me, it wasn't clear how you have the bargaining mm-hmm. protocol. That seems to be decoupled completely from the contagion.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If I understand correctly the model. No?
That's true.
So the
it goes one way, right? The bargaining affects prices, affects quantities that affect contagion, but there is no back there is no effect of contagion on bargaining.
Okay. So then. How does the bargaining affect contagion? Because it was linked to this exposure and
yes.
the threshold, which is a parameter.
Right, right.
It's a parameter.
Threshold is parameter, exposure is endogenous. That's function of bargaining. If you change bargaining, the whole pricing will change, the quantities will change, exposures will change.
Okay.
So for different bargaining, you will have different contagion dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
But the bargaining is not a function of contagion. It's not.
But
doesn't go the other way.
But I don't know if you have specified concretely how exposure is defined in terms of bargaining, of the bargaining outcome. Have you?
I mean, I used it to calculate it, but I didn't have I didn't do any comparative statics. I didn't show any comparative statics. So what it sounds like that maybe it's interesting to do, if you change the bargaining protocol, how contagion changes or how exposure changes. I think that I might have it in the paper. I think I have in the paper what happens when you have equal split of surplus, how that affects contagion and efficiency. I have that in the one of the tables, but I didn't show it today.
Okay, you start from endowments and bargaining rules.
Yes.
That determines exposures.
Yes.
And then there's contagion
yes.
in the resulting network with
right.
endogenous
right.
exposures.
Yeah.
Given the threshold.
Yes, given the threshold. And you can change the threshold. I have also results for different thresholds. But just 15% is I think what people talk about, liquidity requirements, that's ballpark. You know, you put it less, you have more contagion, you raise it, it's less contagion.
I see.
Darryl?
I just wanted to mention a paper by Dan Lee and Norman Chernoff. I think somebody else mentioned it earlier.
Uh-huh.
Which supports the idea that the more central you are, the bigger your gains from trade.
Mm-hmm.
And also is another source of network information.
Exactly.
Information of network.
Yeah, I completely agree. So that's a good point. In the end of the day, I use the Fed Funds data, which is interesting, important market, but it's because of data limitations. I don't have even access to this data. It's Morten Beck and Gina Talai, when they worked in New York Fed, that had access. They published this summary statistics, and I used it to match it. But now we have another paper from the dealers, municipal bonds market, that could produce the same summary statistics. You can use the same model to try to use this to calibrate the model based on this data. But in general, what I want to point out that Copier has a new paper where he shows for the German data the correlation between different networks, so CDS network and the interbank network is 85%. So my hope is that if we believe that in general these OTC markets look like, you know, core periphery structure, low density, very interconnected banks, then this comparative study that I did should capture not just Fed funds market but other markets as well. But completely agree with you.
I wonder what the point is of studying models which, under which quite often you get hundreds of banks failing. I mean, we mustn't be complacent about this, because in the old days people resisted stress tests on the grounds that the scenarios were unduly pessimistic.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, I mean, the reality is that whatever the authorities say, there's no way that they would actually tolerate that happening, and you'd get massive regulatory intervention to stop it. And I think there's a concern amongst some of us that we're getting so seduced by these rather pretty models that we're kind of forgetting that the real issues we have to deal with aren't how do you stop hundreds, a world in which hundreds of banks fail in multiple cascades. I'm not saying that what you're doing is unimportant, because it clearly is important, but I think we need to anchor it a little bit more in the real world. Of regulatory responses, bail-in, and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, that's an excellent question. So, several things here. So first, the model is calibrated to the real data. So that's why, you know, it's not like a model that is completely unrelated. It is calibrated to the real market, but it does generate, for some of the parameters, cascades that we didn't see them as big cascades that we didn't see in the recent crisis. During the Great Depression, we did see 50% of banks fail, so it's just for different reasons, not for this type of mechanism. We did see these magnitudes, but we didn't see it in the recent crisis, and the reason is because of the regulation. So the way to think about it, about the bailout policy and so on, is to think, okay, the model is able to tell you what would happen if you don't bail out. And actually, the model can tell you what happens if you bail out after first round of failure, so after second round of failure. So there is some game between regulators and banks at what is the optimal bailout policy. So I work on this now to try to figure that out. That's not an easy question. But I do think that we should emphasize that if you see many defaults that model produces, it doesn't mean that it's not policy relevant, because it could be off equilibrium. It can be the reason why we see bailouts in the first place. I don't know if I answered your question, but we can talk more.
Any other questions?
Why do you use the preferential attachment
as the
formulation?
Sure.
It seems to be already very...
Sure. So the goal is the following. Remember, I'm trying to search over all possible networks of size 1,000 banks. So that's a huge set. So preferential attachment allows me to just to narrow it a little bit down, because in the end of the day, I do observe in the data one bank that takes loans from 128 banks. So I know that if I have a network where the maximum degree is below 128, there is no way that it will fit the data. So just preferential attachment is just a smart guess for the set of potential networks to search for.
You said you don't have the raw data, but if you did, it would be nice to include not only the first moment effects of in degree, out degree, and average number of counterparties and so on, but also the joint, some covariance, like what's the joint distribution of my number of connections mm-hmm. with my nearest neighbors and their number of connections with their nearest neighbors, so that you get the propagation, sort of the degree of tree, what did Tom call it, locally tree-like moments that we describe in the
sure.
network.
Yeah.
Is there any way to convince people to cough up those second moment?
They have a table, so the original paper, it has many parameters. I'm not sure that they have that, but they do have some clustering parameters that potentially can talk to, you know, maybe indirectly to this type, reciprocity. So this type of things, you can extend it. When I picked these 5 moments, I was just trying to think, okay, for too big to fail problem, what are the major kind of things? I want to have intermediation, because we see intermediation in the market. I want to have banks that are very interconnected, because what's the point of doing comparative studies if you start with homogeneous network? And I wanted to have a low density, because that's what we see. Like, there are no many links. Out of all possible traits, we see only a very small part of it. So that was the main, I think, kind of driving force for me to pick these 5 moments, but I agree with you, we could extend it more, and maybe for contagion it's allowing us to pin down this mechanism even better. I agree.
So I just comment on your non-monotonicity.
This
non-monotonicity is to be expected because in the network literature you find many counterexamples why increasing connectivity should not really affect stability in one way or the other. It happens for very restricted topology. But there is another indicator in which your expected surplus should be monotonic. Yeah, that's if you look at the way you define your contagion, it mainly propagates through weak links, meaning links on which the exposure is
above
higher than the 15.
Yes. Yes.
So if you look at the percentage of those links, and so there's a more refined statistic where you multiply the percentage of those links by the connectivity of the receiving node and the average. That statistic, you can show that it's a good indicator of it should be highly correlated.
Yeah. Thanks. So yeah. So I will look into it. The first comment that you made is that we know that there is non-monotonicity with respect to density. So let me just emphasize that density is not changing here at all. So the density is fixed. So the standard people find non-monotonicity with respect to density. I fix the density. I change only the standard deviation of the degree distribution, right? So that's it's a different non-monotonicity, but maybe it's linked. The problem with the first one that you don't know what is the source for non-monotonicity. Is it because of the one that I showed you, or is it because of the density itself? So, but no. Thanks for. I will look into it.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks a lot.